plan for our next session. We'll continue with the fifth commandment of the Decalogue and concentrate on the sin of envy as underlying the reasons for the fifth commandment being given us by God, anger and envy. And after finishing that, I would like to cope with any questions you may have, so if you wouldn't mind. And I like to finish class by about 10 of 4, put my things together so I can leave at 4 o'clock. Exactly, if I may. And just to refresh your memories then, our next class is May the 9th, and Mass will be at noon, and class will begin, I hope, by 1:30. And then the following last class of this semester, May the 23rd. So May the 9th and May the 23rd. We're going through the Decalogue, and we're on the fifth commandment, which is, you shall not kill. Remember, the wording as it is in the Old Testament simply is that, you shall not kill. But the church has always understood this to mean, you shall not kill an innocent person. The church has never, and the outer is never, forbidden either capital punishment or what we'd call a just war, for example, a war of defense. There are two principal reasons why murder, from the time of Cain to the present day, why murder has been committed: anger and envy. We looked at anger, and now we're going to look at what is called the capital sin of envy. We saw in our last reflection that Christ elevated the Old Testament. In other words, not merely our deeper understanding, but our deeper observance. And the reason, of course, he could do that was, first of all, because he had authority, being God himself. But even more important, Christ gives us the grace. We know can observe the Ten Commandments in a more profound, more demanding, and more self-sacrificing way than was ever possible before the Incarnation. Why? Because we now have the grace that the people in the Old Law simply did not have access to. We saw that homicide has two roots, anger and envy. Anger at heart is the desire for revenge. We don't philosophize or speculate, but that's what happens inside of us. Someone hurts us or offends us, causes us some suffering, humiliation, or pain, and our instinctive urge, without a second thought, is to, as we say, pay back, lash back, strike back. I watched it in a child. Split second is too long. The more that child... Have you seen that? Say, an older brother, an older sister smacks the baby. Years before the age of reason. Oh, but not before the age of the seven capital sins. Right back. That, by the way, is the seven capitals is an action. However, there was a second root for homicide, and that is envy. And that's our reflection now. I'd like to leave about 15 or 20 minutes for questions, say till about 3:30 with a lecture, and then whatever questions you may have. The English word envy comes from the Latin invidia. Envious, of course, is one term, but invidious is a more accurate adjective to describe a person who has envy. And we will ask, as we have been asking, four questions. What is Christ teaching on envy? Then, what is envy? Thirdly, what are some of the consequences of envy? And what is so important, what are some remedies for the vice of envy? First then, Christ's teaching. Although implied in much of his teaching of the Gospels, our Lord's most detailed explanation and condemnation of envy occurs almost at the end of his public ministry. It occurs in the 20th chapter of Matthew's Gospel, first 16 verses. It's in the form of a parable. Over the years in teaching my own Jesuits, I have told them that Christ's parables, there are 72 in the widest counting of parables, 72 parables, some very short, in the Gospels. Christ's principal way of teaching in the moral order was through parables. And for all of you, I hope, who want to share the faith with others, the most effective way of teaching morality is by telling stories and take your lesson from Christ. Some parables are long, but very few. Most of them are short. It is the parable of the laborers in the vineyard. And because of its importance, I think I should read all 16 verses, trusting this is a good translation. The kingdom of heaven is like a householder who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. And having agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And about the third hour, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace idle. He said to them, "Go you also into my vineyard, and I'll give you whatever is just." So they went. And again he went out about the sixth and about the ninth hour and did as before. At about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing about. And he said to them, "Why do you stand here all day idle?" They said to him, "Because no man has hired us." He said to them, "Go you also into my vineyard." When evening had come, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, "All the laborers, and pay them their wages, beginning from the last even to the first." Now when they of the 11th hour came, they received each a denarius and when the first of their turn came, they thought they would receive more. Well, they also received each his denarius. On receiving it, they began to murmur against the householder, saying, "These last have worked a single hour, and you have put them on a par with us. We have borne the burden of the day's heat." But answering one of them, he said, "Friend, I do you no injustice. Do you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what is yours and go. I choose to give those even as much as I'm giving to you. Do I not have a right to do what I choose? Or are you envious because I am generous?" Even so, the last shall be first, and the first last. For many are called, but few are chosen. What then are we being told? Christ, remember, taught most of his moral doctrine in parabolic form. Different levels at different times of the day. Early in the morning, third hour, sixth hour, ninth hour, 11th hour. Each of these five groups of laborers received the same wage. But the owner, wisely, starts to pay those who came last and ends with those who came first. And given human nature, we are all naturally, all of us, envious. All of us. When then the owner comes to pay those who have been working all day, to be exact, 8 hours. That, by the way, is where the 8-hour day began. I don't mean they worked only 8 hours at the time of Christ, but picked up, especially from post-Reformation times. Everybody received the same wage. The response of the owner to those who complained was, "Are you envious because I am generous?" Let's be clear what Christ is telling us. Needless to say, there is not a labor union in the world that would buy this theology. That's part one. Now part two, what is envy? Envy is sadness at the excellence, good fortune, or success of another person. Envy is sadness at the excellence, good fortune, or success of another person. The main reason for the breakdown of marriages is envy. It took me 45 years to learn that. How will I know? Envy implies that I consider myself somehow deprived by what I envy in another person, or even that an injustice has been done to me. Envy, therefore, is not merely sadness that someone has some desirable talent or possession, nor certainly the ambition to surpass or equal another person. Because we may be bothered that somebody has succeeded where I have failed, or has what I lack. And then all I have to do is ask myself, how hard am I working? One reason why some people succeed is because they work. But the enemy is different. In other words, envy is not the same as jealousy. And I would say, of 100 people that I either listen to or read, I don't know the figures, but I would say less than maybe 3 or at most 5 have a really distinguish in their minds between jealousy and envy. Either one is not the other. Jealousy implies that I have something which I don't want to share. In other words, I jealously hold on to what I have got. But envy is just the opposite. I don't have what somebody else does have, and I'm sad just because that person has whatever it is. The first and very extensive, we've mentioned this more than once, document of the first century. The first document from a bishop of Rome, of course, besides the 2 letters of Peter, the first document, papal document, and the first century, issued, remember, by Pope Clement I to the Corinthians, and is all about envy. It is envy that is rocking the Catholic Church to her foundations. How well I know what names I could name. So the Pope is supposed to be head of the church, is he? Say he's the vicar of Christ? I don't buy that. Name, you may know. Bishop. 1 long article, National Magazine. I am the vicar of Christ. The Pope can have his Rome. I've got mine. The most serious sin of envy, therefore, is sadness at somebody having what I lack. But the most serious form of envy is when I am sad that someone has spiritual gifts or is receiving supernatural graces that I am not getting. And you'll have to read quite a few books to read this. The main reason why Christ was hated by the Sadducees, the scribes, and the Pharisees was they envied him, and then envied especially his sanctity. There has never been a saint whose life I've read who was not envied by his or her contemporaries. It's very dangerous, by the way, to be blessed by God. You're going to pay for it dearly. So much for what is envy. Now the results of envy. The results of envy are past counting. They are practically a summation of all the evils in revealed history. It was envy of God that caused the fall of the angels. The devils came into existence through envy. It was envy which brought on the fall of our first parents. The devil envied their happiness, tempted Eve. She tempted Adam. She brought sin into the human race. Not sure whether I've given you this. I like St. Vincent Ferrer's comparison between Christ's identification of his followers and Satan's identification of his followers. Have we had this? Oh. St. Vincent Ferrer, a great Dominican spiritual writer, says Christ, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another, as I have loved you." Satan says, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you envy one another, as I have envied you." Forty plus years in the priesthood, God has put thousands of souls into my life. And especially when, if a person believes that he or she is to do something great for God, or I'm to find someone for some apostolic endeavor, what I look for is a person a victim of envy? You're all prone to envy. All of us, question mark. All of us, exclamation mark. All of us. And we are going to be only as effective channels of grace used by Christ as we master this vice of envy. We go on with a narrative in the Bible. It was envy that caused Saul to want to murder David because David was so popular and successful. It was, as we're saying, envy which caused the scribes and Pharisees to persecute Christ, have him condemned, and finally had him crucified on Calvary. So the litany of the results of envy go on. In summary, there are five principal consequences of envy. Each one deserves at least 1 hour of commentary. This I'm drawing on the wisdom of 2,000 years of the Church's teaching. The first result of envy is hatred of the person envied. You don't have to grit your teeth, you don't have to clench your fists. You may smile at the person. And some people are masters in masking their envy. I've watched them. Professionals. Interior hatred. Second, criticism of the envied person. Over the years in counseling so many people, how hard it is to not be conscious of another person's failings. And we're going to be asked perceptive of other people's failings and criticize them first to ourselves and then to others in the measure that we envy that person. Call it a compensation. In other words, the person is, say, gifted in ways that I'm not, has what I lack, So, envy then inspires, shall I use the verb, inspires me to find weaknesses, failings, faults in that person who I know in my mind is superior to me. Thirdly, detraction of the envied person's character. Depending on the degree of envy, there'll be the gravity of the detraction. Remember, detraction is not telling a lie about another person. That's calumny. Detraction is telling what is true about the person. But it's not of the person's business to whom I'm speaking. Detraction, therefore, of the envied person's character. Sure, he or she has this or that, and I know it. Deep down in my soul, I know it. How well I know it. It's eating me. So what do? And again, begins inside of me. Detraction is first interior, so that I will minimize that person's estimate in my own mind, because my mind tells me that person has what I lack, or has succeeded where I have failed. Fourth result of envy, resentment at the envied person's prosperity, praise, or achievement. Resentment. For he has done nothing to me at all. Maybe, and I have to say this, maybe my wife or my husband. Maybe my brother or sister. Maybe my own child, a son or daughter. Maybe my father or mother. Kinship is no respecter of persons when it comes to the vice of envy. Resentment. In counseling married people who have marital problems, first of all, I think I've said this publicly, I always look to see who is envying whom and why. And I can tell you this, I've yet to have failed in not seeing envy as one of the roots of every marital disorder. I couldn't have said this 25 years ago. I see it now. Finally, what a consequence of envy. Joy. Joy that the envied person has some misfortune or adversity. Oh, again, depending on how professional we are, how clever we are, oh, what sympathy we can pour out. What kind, soothing words. But deep down inside, serves a right. And I'm the judge. Now, some remedies. Concretely, to begin to cure ourselves of envy. And as vice remains, I know what I'm saying, throughout our lives. To begin to cure ourselves of envy, the masters of the spiritual life especially recommend 4 practices. First, and this can take a lot of effort, think kindly of the person that you envy. In fact, the moment you're tempted to envy the person, a red light should go on. Find something well, good about the person. Praiseworthy in your own eyes. And I say this, it is very hard, in spite of the psychiatrists, it is very hard to think unkindly of ourselves. Oh, the hypocrisy, I say this, of most practitioners of psychiatry. I don't think I've ever said this publicly before. The hypocrisy. You don't love yourself enough. My God. That's not the problem. We always think kindly of ourselves. It's beginning, therefore. The first remedy recommended, therefore, by the masters of the spiritual life is to think some kind thought about that person. And, of course, we won't have these thoughts unless we have been, well, perceptive and observant. We find what we look for. We've got to begin to cultivate the habit of seeing good in other people so we can think kindly and charitably and generously about them. And this, by the way, again, my priestly experience has taught me so much I never read in books. If you want to win over a person who, from all appearances, dislikes you, especially, say, a person who is estranged from God, left the faith, hostile to what you believe, if you want to win the grace of that person's not just affection for you, which may not be so important, as conversion to the God from whom that person has strayed, act, no matter what it costs you, act kindly, generously toward that person. The last person on earth you'd want to smile to, the last person on earth you would like to perform some act of courtesy. Do it. Why? To give that person the opportunity for beginning to think kindly of you. And I know what I'm talking about. The worst hatred is a hatred engendered by envy. Secondly, how to overcome envy. Act kindly to the person whom you are tempted to envy. First of all, think kindly. Secondly, act kindly. And for some people, this may not be easy. Especially if the person is obviously superior to me in so many ways. How can I help that person in such a way that I will then begin to control and master my envy of that person? And work in both ways. Envy that we are tempted to, and therefore that we are to think and act kindly of and toward the persons that we envy, and they in turn thinking and acting correspondingly towards us. And this is most important, especially having taught so many gifted fellow Jesuits. And you can see the trial they're going through, that there's such a thing as suffering from being envied. And that you are careful and prudent in not, you might say, stirring up the flames of envy in that person. I think I should say this. As much as possible, whenever you've done something which is both praiseworthy and therefore enviable, avoid as much as you can of publicizing it. Am I clear? So far from telling people about it, don't even bring it up. Because every achievement on the part of the person who is envied just stokes the flames of envy even more. Thirdly, do good for the person that you envy. This is different from acting kindly. In other words, if I want to overcome envy in myself, I must not only think and act kindly toward that person, but even with that person being absent, not even knowing what I'm doing, do some good for that person. Am I clear? This will win grace that you need to overcome, I repeat, the virus of envy. And finally, pray. Pray for the person whom you are tempted to envy. Somebody has achieved where you have failed. For example, you're in competition with somebody, and that person won, and you lost. That you pray immediately for the one, well, who was the victor, and you were the loser. With this I close. St. John Chrysostom says, there's a double crown for those who conquer this vice. There is first the crown, a victory over envy. There is secondly, the crown for the practice of charity. Because the hardest charity on earth to practice is towards those whom we envy. It took me years to learn that. On each of these four, I could spend 1 hour, and I trust would have been a useful conference. And now some questions. I must say you are very generous with your questions. The Abbe George Nant has written a critical analysis of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It is published by the Catholic Counter-Reformation in the 20th century. Is it something that we should believe? I don't know much about the man, but I would say from what I know, the answer is no. On Good Friday, 4 out of the 5 churches in Jackson, Michigan, offered only 1 bare, corpusless cross to the whole congregation for veneration. Are we supposed to venerate the crucifix on Good Friday? Yes. And it better be a crucifix and not just two pieces of wood or metal. Our sisters allowed to baptize and confirm people at the Easter Vigil. First of all, they cannot confirm, not a question of being allowed. They cannot confirm anybody. They should not baptize. Assuming we're not talking about some jungle in Africa where a priest only comes, say, once in 3 years. No. Please explain the phrase holy envy. Depends on who uses it. Of course, envy as a vice is unholy. However, sometimes, I never use the word myself, people may speak of envy when they really mean emulation. Emulation is not envy. Emulation is recognizing the achievement or the virtue or the quality that somebody else has that I obviously lack. If I emulate and I strive, not because I'm sad, but I'm glad the person has what I lack, so I want to get that too. Find out, what does that person do, say, to me, well, so smart. I study. How come that person, well, publishes books? Or that person stays up nights writing. Person is not lazy. So, holy envy is sometimes used as a synonym for emulation. Emulation is seeing the achievements of other people and wanting to get what that person has, but happy that person has it, and also want to, if I can with God's help, attain the same. I'm enjoying a book entitled 17 Lost Years of Jesus by Elizabeth Clare Prophet. She has been on the news briefly. Do you know of her? She has other books I would like to read, for I've enjoyed this one so much. Do you think it's okay to read her books? I don't know Elizabeth Hare or Clare. Or is it Dare? Is it Dare?
Clare.
What is it?
Clare.
Clare, the prophet. I would say, first of all, I'd like to see the book, something she published. But until then, I would not recommend reading Elizabeth Clare, the prophet. If you attend a Sunday Mass somewhere, such as when traveling, and a priest changed the Mass, especially the consecration, and you sincerely doubt the Mass was valid, are you obliged to find a Mass somewhere else? I would say, in general, no, because there are so many reasons that people have now for wondering about the validity of the consecration. In general, I would say, assume the consecration was valid unless the opposite could be proved. Is the entire encyclical Humanae Vitae infallible? No. Not everything which the Pope says in Humanae Vitae is irreversible doctrine, because much of it is explanation, commentary. What is certainly irreversible. And that's the best synonym, by the way, for infallible. Infallibility belongs to the authority teaching. Irreversibility belongs to that which is taught. And start using the word irreversible. For those who question infallibility, that's what they're after. They want, well, the doctrine to be reversed, right? So, do you know anything about the Society of Jesus Christ the Priest? Can't say I do. If the question would find out something, I'd be very happy to hear. The church teaches that Mary was ever a virgin before, during, and after the birth of Jesus, with no disturbance of her physical virginity in the birth of Jesus. Is it correct to believe that Mary did not undergo the pain of childbirth? Yes. Not only correct, but I would say part of the church's teaching. Remember, already in Genesis, the pangs or pains of childbirth are the result of sin. Mary did not experience pain from within. All the pain, as with Christ, had to be somehow caused from outside.